This is part one of a two-parter with Mads Torgersen about C# 9. In this part, he and I discuss some of the new features in C# 9, and in part two, Mads will address listener questions. This is the No Dabba Podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening I'm joined by Mads Torgersen, lead designer for C# at Microsoft, and he's joining me from Seattle. Thank you very much for taking time out of your evening, Mads.
Thanks for having me on your show again. It's great.
Tonight, we are going to talk about C# 9. We have in the past talked about C# 8 and C# 7. But for anyone who hasn't listened to those, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, please?
Yeah, well, I'm this guy originally from Denmark who somehow luckily landed a gig at Microsoft that led me to eventually become the lead designer of C#. So I've been there for 15 years next month. And for the first long while, I worked alongside Anders Heilsberg. And when he moved on to TypeScript, I was passed the baton to be the lead designer of this language. So so that's me.
You've been in Seattle the whole 15 years?
In the area, yeah. I actually just moved to Seattle, the city, a couple of months ago, just before COVID.
COVID. We won't talk about that. No, you're absolutely. We won't. Anyone listener, we're not going to talk about that. What does the lead designer for C# do?
Well, I'm the only one whose full-time job it is to design C#. But of course, I'm too lazy to do it all on my own. And Anders handed down like this awesome design process that really is the key to how C# is doing so relatively well as it's evolving, which is that we have a set of we have a design team of people who are have day jobs, but they have they all have a stake or an interest in C#, and they have lots of experience and many different perspectives. And we meet a lot, like we meet twice a week for 2 hours, and do the design as a group effort. So so my job is to coordinate all that and to, of course, do a lot of the thinking. And I'm sort of responsible for a coherent whole coming out that is focusing on the important things and is responsible and sustainable and focused on the long term and all those things. Like, I'm the only one who gets dinged if these things aren't done properly.
Are you free to tell us the names of some of the people that are involved in these meetings?
Yeah, it's a public secret. You can actually see the setup of the design team is a team on GitHub because that's a set of people who have what we call championing privileges in our public repo. So it's not a secret at all. We have we have Dustin Campbell, who many people will know. We have Miguel de Casa, of Xamarin fame. We have Kathleen Dollard, who's also the lead for VB and who was an MVP for many years before she joined us, and so on. We have a team of about 10 people now. Some are from the C# compiler team, but many are from other teams, including rather faraway teams where they just they're experts, or they have a history with C# and so on that makes them great for having on this design team.
Is there any input from outside Microsoft into this?
Oh, plenty. About half a decade ago, we decided to open source the actual design process. And so there's a dedicated GitHub repo, .NET/C#lang for the C# language design, and all our assets are there. We have thousands of issues there with where people suggest things or we discuss things. And all the artifacts that come out of the design process, all the design notes from the meetings, all the proposals and so on, they're all there. So people can just participate on a day-to-day level if they want. If they have the stomach for following along at the pretty rapid clip that it sometimes takes place at.
There's something that I think maybe a lot of people don't know about you, that you are Dr. Mads Torgersen, holder of a PhD. Can you talk about that a little?
I always thought I was going to go into research, not always, but for a long while, after I started computer science, it seemed to me I enjoyed teaching, I enjoyed coming up with stuff. It seemed to me I was cut out to be a researcher. And so I took a PhD and I got a job at a university, and I was there for 4 years. And some parts of the experience I did enjoy, but parts of it, it turned out what I enjoyed the most out of that time was, well, I always enjoyed the teaching, and now I get to do the speaking instead, and that sort of, but other than that, what I enjoyed the most from a research perspective was a collaboration project I had within Sun Microsystems, who were developing Java on the language evolution, Java generics and Java wildcards. And that opened my eyes to how much more fun it was to have real users and to do design under real industrial constraints, you know, things you can't do because compat or for many, many other reasons. So that was so much fun. And I decided, hey, if I want to do that anyway, I might as well, you know, get paid private industry wages instead of being on a public salary. So, and my wife and I were kind of looking for an adventure anyway at the time. So, so that turned into switching careers and joining Microsoft as a program manager.
And that was straight into the C# lead designer role?
Well, I wasn't lead designer at the time because Anders Heilsberg was there.
He was still there.
My title fluctuated a little, but after 6 months, I became the language PM. We just invented the title language PM for me, which gave me the appropriate cover to focus mostly on the language. And that meant that I did a lot of the organizational stuff around it. And I quickly started taking over writing the language design notes out of the design meetings, with Anders at the end of the table making the decisions when there was contention and so on, and me sort of as his trusty helper.
And we have a listener question about that, but we'll get to it later. But for tonight, the main focus of our chat will be about C# 9. When is it coming out?
If all goes well, it should be out in November, along with .NET 5.
We're going to talk about some of the, I suppose, the main features that are coming out in C# 9. And you know, I'm following a blog post that you've written. And at the very top is what are called init-only properties. Can you tell me about those?
Yeah, you know, one thing that, what seemed like an inconsequential addition to C# all the way back in C# 3 when we did language integrated query, you know, link and all those things, was what we called object initializers. Before that time, if your constructor didn't fully initialize the object, or you know, and you wanted to assign to it to specific properties yourself, well, you would have to do that in separate assignment statements. You know, create the object, then assign into it. And we were like, it'd be nicer if there was an expression-based way of doing that, so that you could do that inside of a link query and so on. So we added object initializers to the language then. And they really took off and took on a life of their own, completely outside of the link scenario, because it turns out if you base your object model on object initializers instead of constructors, then you get a lot of benefits out of that. One of them is that the class library that you're using is a lot less brittle. You don't have to have this whole chaining that you do with constructors, where the most specific constructor in your hierarchy has to take all the things and pass some of them on to its base class, that passes them on to its base class and its constructor and so on. And if you change anything at any one of these levels, you have to go and fix everything up everywhere. You have this brittleness between classes in a hierarchy, and also between the hierarchy and the end user of the classes who's constructing things and have to know exactly what to pass in which order and so on. So constructors are actually kind of crappy for object-oriented programming, in a way that they introduce too many dependencies that are too hard and it becomes too brittle. And object initializers, they pretty much take care of all of that. Because you're just directly, even though you're still writing an expression, you're just directly assigning values into the members of the class in question. And I've talked to people who have as a rule, like an engineering rule, that we don't use constructors with arguments. We just use object initializers in our company, because that's the only way to keep things stable and properly separated. And that's been kind of baffling to us, but also like there seemed to be a there that we weren't quite like giving a full, giving all the attention that it needed. Because one of the, of course, one of the most obvious, there are a few like downsides to using object initializers, but the most obvious one is your object has to be mutable. It has to, the properties that you want to initialize with an object initializer have to have a setter. So, the price of using object initializers is you have to have an immutable object model, even if that wasn't, even if you didn't intend for objects to be mutated after they were created, in order to enable the object initializers that are logically part of creation, you would have to pay that price and make your objects vulnerable to accidental later mutations, or you know, you couldn't pass them around freely without worrying that somebody would accidentally change them later. So with the sort of growing interest in immutable programming, object initializers create this tension between, yeah, they're the right thing to do, but they're the wrong thing to do. You know, they give you the right properties around initialization, but at the cost of being vulnerable to mutation. What can we do? Well, let's make properties that can only be mutated during initialization. And that's what init-only properties are.
So you're limited to at that very time and not subsequently.
Yes, inside of the curly braces that are your object initializer, you can change the property, and after the end curly, it is set in stone. You can't mutate it anymore.
Because I was going to say, before you got to that point, I was going to say you often see in books, it might have been Code Complete, or it may have been another one, talking about how a constructor enforces a class to have everything it needs. Whereas if you have no constructor, you know, you may not have that dependency that you need. It is a slightly different argument at the point you were making. But what about that, though? Let's say I have a controller that needs a entity framework to be injected into it through a constructor. I can't do that through property setters because I can't be sure it's ever going to be there. So I'm never sure I have a valid controller.
That's a great point. And that is, and that brings us to sort of to what is probably the second biggest problem with object initializers. So now we address the biggest one, and we talked a lot about how to address the second biggest one, which is making sure that people actually do set it. That because by the very nature, object initializers are, you know, for each given property, they're optional. You can set it or you can leave it out. So we're looking at whether we can. That's not for C# 9, but we're looking at as a next step, can we address that by making properties that are mandatory, like that if they're not set by the constructor, the user is forced to set them when they create the object, like they can't leave them off.
So then it's going to be a combination of constructor along with init properties to get you to that valid state?
Yeah, and the thing you can do today or in C# 9 that you can already do is if you have something that's mandatory, you know, maybe keep it as a constructor parameter for now, because that's the way you make sure that people will provide it. And then if that's really important to you, then you can do that because that's the only way of ensuring that people pass it when they create the object for now. But we are looking at taking the next step with init-only properties or in connection with sort of the creation by object initializer. We sometimes call it nominal creation, where you name the properties as they are being set instead of passing them in as parameters in a parameter list. And we have some good ideas, but not a fully fledged proposal yet for how best to declare that and for how it interacts with some of the other ideas we have for evolving this paradigm.
With the init-only properties, do they still have the ability to have a public or private get on them?
You can freely control the getter. Essentially, think of an init-only property is a variant of a normal get set property where instead of set, you say init. So it's an init accessor. It's like the setter, but everything else is the same. So you can do whatever you could do with get set properties, you can also do with get init properties. And the only difference is that the init accessor can't be invoked after the object has been created.
But is there a set accessor that can be invoked after it's been created?
No, you can't have both a set and an init accessor.
Okay, so it's one or the other.
So if you want things to be mutated after, you just use a setter. And if you don't, you use an initter. It's either or.
Gotcha. Another completely new feature that's on the way is something that's referred to as records. What are they? Why are they important?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that we find is that oftentimes when people want to represent data, that is sort of fairly dumb data, flat data, if you will, or, oftentimes data that's serialized and deserialized from the wire or databases and so on, then all the defaults in C# around data types, around classes, are kind of wrong. sometimes you want to treat data more as values and less as individual objects with mutable state and sort of an evolving life of their own. That's often the wrong model for data. And you tend to want to treat them more as values, more like immutable values. And now you have to go and change everything. You want to have maybe, first you want the immutability by default. You want to have value-based equality, maybe, where when you compare two of them, you're not compared based on object identity, which is the default for objects, but you compare based on what's inside. You know, that's the important thing for their value. You also, if you have immutable objects, you want to be able to work with them somehow more conveniently. There's this pattern or a style of programming called non-destructive mutation, which is that you work with immutable objects always, and when you want to change quote unquote something, you do it by creating a new one that's like the old one but with the thing changed, right? You simply, there's an old version of Brian and there's a new version of Brian representing what changed. He changed his last name or his employment or whatever. You create a new record of Brian representing that, but the old one can still coexist with it and represent the historical fact that you used to be in this other state. That step from the old Brian to the new Brian is relatively hard and cumbersome and boilerplate rich to support in C# today. And so one of the things that records add is the ability to, they add inherent support for non-destructive mutation, where I can create, through what is called with expressions, I can create a new Brian from the old Brian by saying old Brian with, and then an object initializer saying the things that should be different in the new Brian, and then you get a copy of Brian with those things changed. So a record is a kind of class declaration that automatically gives you value-based equality and automatically supports with expressions.
And can that go down a tree? So, to go back to entity framework, if I was doing something like loading up a person with their related addresses and their related friends and their pets, and then if I attempt to use a record to create a slightly different version of it, can it traverse all of those objects that are part of the parent object?
By default, the equality of the, if you're talking about equality now?
I'm not sure. I'm talking about more the idea of if I had that one, let's say that Brian representation that contained 20 other objects within it, and I wanted to change a sub object like the address line one, can I go down and navigate through that Brian object to his address, to his address line one, and only change that and get the rest of it the same?
Yeah, you could nest with expression, so to speak, so that you would say that you get old Brian with address equals, and then you can dot your way down in there. It's a little awkward to do so, but you can. And then you create a new Brian with a slightly changed address.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, you have that support. Actually, since I'm asking about the entity framework side, I imagine there must be complications around entity framework if you were doing something like that with something you had loaded from a database, because then you would attempt to add that new thing back to the context. Would there be any kind of gotchas when you're doing that?
You're not mutating things, so you would have to explicitly store the new one instead of the old one. And various frameworks might have different, approaches to that.
Yeah, because that's what's popping into my head. I wonder if you would have copied, let's say, the innards of what the entity framework representation is also, so that it might view it as a duplicate as opposed to a update. I don't know. I'm going down a rabbit hole.
Yeah, we'd have to sort of, we'd probably have to have something in front of us, which is hard in this medium.
So you mentioned value-based equality. Can you go into that a little bit more? Is it used only within the records within C#, or is it used for other things too?
For now, we discussed whether to make it something you could opt into for any class declaration. For now, we said it's only part of records. Like, we will only generate it for you if you're part of records. It works the same way as equality already works for structs, actually. If you compare two structs in C# today, two value types, they will compare field by field. And they will call equals recursively on the fields inside, which then again might call equals on the fields inside if they also have value-based equality, and sort of do a deep dive recursion on it. And we implemented value-based equality the same way for records, which means you have to be a little careful if you're creating cycles in your object graph. Equality might chase those cycles around forever. But on the other hand, if you have immutable objects, it's very hard to create a cycle, so they kind of go together nicely.
Another new feature that you talk about in your blog post is top-level programs. What are they, and why did you introduce them?
Yeah, this is, at the heart of it, I guess, this is just a convenience feature. This is syntactic sugar more than anything else, but really important syntactic sugar, I think. One of the things that is starting to feel a little so 90s in C# is the amount of code you have to write just to write a little program. Before you get to writing your first statement, you have to have a class, and inside of that class you have to have a method with a certain name and structure, and only then inside of that method can your program start. And you kind of have to go look for where is that method with the, it doesn't distinguish itself in any way syntactically. And so that seems to be a lot of boilerplate and a lot of hurdle for writing the main program. And so we decided, hey, let's just allow you to write the main program at the top of the file, right after whatever usings you have. Just write the main program as statements directly at the top, indented all the way to the left. And you can do that instead of having a main. You do that in one file. You choose what file to put it in. You put a program in there. It's nothing new and fancy. We don't try to recombine statements from different files or something. It all has to be in one place, just like the main method. It's just that your code becomes more readable. The main program stands out more. And also from a sort of learning perspective, it means that you can sit down and start learning to code, experimenting with coding, without somebody having to tell you these 20 things in your around you that you don't have to worry about yet, that there are all these extraneous concepts that are right in your face that you have to actively work to ignore all the time. So both from a learning perspective and just from a program cleanliness perspective, we think this is probably what I was joking in one of my talks about it that the only time I will write a main method from now on is when I'm demoing this feature as the before code before I move it out to the top level, because it's just nicer.
It is one of those things that I'm noticing more now that I'm learning Node on the side as something I'm interested in, that how much work is involved in getting a C# or a .NET or an ASP.NET application up and running. But I suppose the question becomes, when .NET 5 comes out and I say .NET new console or I say .NET new web API, will that main exist as a using system and then off it goes, or will it be using system, class, program, static, void, main, and off? You know, will Microsoft make this part of the default template?
I hope so, but honestly, I don't know yet whether I don't know yet. Yeah. There's still a few months till we ship, and I haven't made sure that's going to happen. Sooner or later, it will. Will it make it into .NET 5? I'm not sure.
But is there a more broad goal of making applications source code smaller for us, so that, you know, again, the idea of a web API application, you have your main, you've got your startup, you've got your configure services, you've got your configure, you have your constructors, you have your controller with its constructor, with its action methods. You know, there's a significant amount of code before you can return a hello world as a JSON string. When you compare it to something like Go or Node or Rust, it's a few lines.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say it's a goal we share across all of .NET. In some ways, .NET shows its age. It was born in the Java age, and there was a certain tolerance, even like preference for verbosity back then. Like, people liked that their programs looked big and sturdy. it somehow felt more professional. I don't know. But we've definitely erred on the side of generality over simplicity in many ways, some of which were just like how things were done at the time and we didn't know better. Things have evolved to where we now understand how to do things more simply. And some of it is just like, maybe over-focusing on that expressiveness and not on the beginner scenario or the lightweight scenario and those things. And we're really trying to, and we have been for years now, trying to clean up our act, so to speak, and make it so that both in the language and in the various frameworks under .NET, including ASP.NET, so that you have to say less. It's always a dangerous balance, right? Because there are two ways of making code smaller, as you say. I mean, one of them is to make it more cryptic, to like let you say contorted things so that you can do it in fewer lines of code. And we want to try to avoid that. Whereas one is to make your code more clear by removing boilerplate or redundant stuff, by taking the fluff away so that your business logic stands out loud and clear, and so that your type structure stands out loud and clear. And we're trying to do more of that. Records are part of that, for instance, by saying, hey, if the general trend is that my objects are in this particular object model, that they're immutable and value oriented, then let's not clutter them up with all the code to implement that manually. Let's have the language do that for you behind the scenes. Top level statements are in that same vein. Like, let's take the clutter away. Expression bodied members were the same kind of thing over the last couple of versions of C#, or C# 6 and 7, I guess, where we allowed you to have very small, terse, clear implementations of members that didn't have extraneous stuff that you didn't need. So we're trying to do the right thing here, not just smaller for smaller's sake, but for clarity's sake, and to make the important stuff stand out.
And there's no doubt that it has gotten a lot simpler to use. I mean, if you compare, you know, an application now to, let's say, a .NET framework web forms, know, the amount of stuff you needed to know about a page lifecycle back then was immense to get things working. And it's, you know, the thing I find, I suppose, impressive is that with far less code, I can do far more, and it's far easier to understand. You know, right. Even WCF was more difficult than Web API. Web API in .NET Core is easier to work with than, let's say, Web API 2 or 1 when it came out. It is getting easier. I guess where one of the things, and this is nothing to do directly with C#, one of the things I find challenging is when we move from the likes of Core 2.1 to 3.1, some stuff breaks or some nomenclature changes, and it's kind of, I can't just take my code and go into CSproj and say, now it's 3.1. I have to go root around in program, or I have to go root around in startup, or the action result is now iAction result. That kind of churn, I think, has occasionally pushed people away from .NET. And maybe churn is too strong, but it has certainly made it a little less accessible for people.
Right. And that's that's a big challenge of being what is still, even in these .NET Core days, is still a legacy technology in some ways, right? .NET is a technology with a long history. And every time you break someone, every time you change how you do things, it's painful. And every time you don't, now you're leaving another kind of goodness on the table, and in another way, it becomes painful, right? So as software development evolves, both in terms of the scenarios that you address and the context you're in, but also just the things we know how to do, we have to find a balance between making the better stuff available, even in this 20-plus-year-old technology, versus breaking you all the time. Like that's a balancing act that we have to do. And I think we have been very bound by compatibility in the past, when we were strongly tied to Windows as a Windows component and couldn't just change things without breaking end users. So now we've been set a little more free from that, and we are able to break things a little more, but we still have to remember that the developers are still, even if the end users are now saved, you know, the developers still have to deal with any breaks that we do and find that, you know, find the right balance.
Is it fair to say that you on the C# side have been more hesitant to make any breaking changes? I believe you've never made a breaking change, whereas on the .NET or the ASP.NET side, they are a little more free to make breaking changes.
Yeah, that's probably true. The closer you get to the core of things, the inevitable core, of course, the more hesitant you have to be about breaking changes, because now you affect everyone. Like we do have every single version of C# has breaking changes, but they're tiny, and we have a very high bar for making them. Sometimes there are bug fixes that we have to do because otherwise we leave something unsafe. But fixing the bug means that you could have written something that will now give an error or something. Oh. So we do it on a case-by-case basis. We do actually do small breaking changes. And we are experimenting with that dial a little bit for every release, especially since we moved fully onto .NET Core. But if you think about it, the runtime under us has to be even more conservative. They cannot make breaking changes to say, hey, how we evaluate this IL instruction has now changed, you know, that. Whereas the things that build on top of us, the core libraries are sort of the next layer. And then you get to application frameworks like ASP.NET. And the further out you get, the more free you can be with this. So still keeping in mind that there are customers that that will cry hot tears if you go too far. So we're close to the bottom of the stack there, and we have to be really careful not to break people too much. But we are experimenting with that line, because sometimes the right thing to do really requires us to move something over a little bit that was never a good thing to do to start with, but people might have done accidentally or because they could.
Would you like to give an example, or?
Well, let's, if an example right now is the record keyword that we introduce in C# 9 that tells people that this class declaration is actually a record declaration. Well, record hasn't always been a keyword in the language. And we've introduced many more keywords to the language over time. We never introduced them as true keywords because people might have used them as identifiers. And if we introduce them as true keywords now, every use of that identifier would break. Like imagine somebody not a method because that would be uppercase, but let's say a delegate that is called record. Well, that would be broken now if record became a keyword. So we try to make all those new keywords contextual. Like we try to make it so that we can look around, the parser can look around them and say, okay, there's no other thing it could have meant here. But occasionally, and I think, I can't remember the exact way in which, I think the record keyword, there are certain ways in which what we're doing with it now, it's out in preview, so hopefully if we're wrong about how rare it would be, we'll find out before we commit to it. But there are certain ways in which you could have written something very unlikely that would already have parsed differently than what we do with it today. And we sort of say, let's try, because otherwise we really can't see our way out of using a keyword for declaring records. And we do need to use keywords to use a keyword here. So that's an example where hopefully nobody gets broken by it. We try to make sure that these are really rare scenarios, but you know, maybe we're wrong. We always worry about that.
But in order to get broken by it, they would have to move to .NET 5 and C# 9?
Yeah.
Which again is probably less likely.
Right. Another thing that we try to do, so the new compiler has a language version flag, which lets you set a lower language version. But we've tried to steer away from having different parsing between the different levels. Like we parse the whole thing and then we just give you an error if you use one of the new features. But the more we engage in breaks, the more we will probably have to like have alternate paths in the parser depending on which version of the language it is, which makes the compiler source base more fragile and fickle and hard to test. And so we really, it's a delicate dance.
Do you get statistics about the, let's say, the number of applications that are being written or running in C# 8 versus 7? And then when 9 comes along, will you see, you know, it's 10%, it's 20%, it's 1%?
Well, we don't get telemetry from the compiler itself.
Yeah.
That's just a software component that people can use wherever and whenever they want in various ways. We get some statistics from Visual Studio, which, you know, there we get telemetry of various sorts. And so we can see some of the adoption of the language as it happens there. But to be honest, there's not a whole lot of very useful telemetry we get. We have a sense that people, by and large, adopt the language versions very quickly. As soon as they adopt the version of the framework, they also adopt the version of the language. Because there's really no downside. Right? Okay, you have a few more features available. As long as everyone in the team agrees to move on to the next version of the language, then there's really no downside.
No, that's true. I guess the only slight difference is with .NET 5, I think is it 1 year? That's the expected support level or support period for it, because when .NET 6 comes out approximately a year later, then you've got 90 days to move on.
Yeah, there's whether there's long-term support or not, that in our planned cadence for .NET, every other version, every other year has long-term support. And every other doesn't. And there's a certain cadence there. Again, the language is not likely to be where things will stop working or go out of support or anything like that, because we are really very careful about only adding to the language. Like these breaking changes are super in the corners.
That's the end of part one. In a few weeks, I'll post part two, where Mads will address listener questions. including one asking how he manages to stay so good-looking. If you like this episode, you might also like episode 144 with Bill Wagner about .NET 5, or episode 124 with Mads Torgersen about C-sharp 8. The opening music was Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was The Ombak by Little Glass Men from the album Simplify